Hello and welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Dave.
And I'm Annie. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, TV show or book we were a fan of before we were married and that the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
This month, however, we have a special guest, our friend Richard, who has selected our topic for this episode's discussion. Richard's choice was the 1980s children's TV show, The Adventure Game. So, why did you pick it?
Well, when I was a kid, so we're talking when I was perhaps 7 or 8, that kind of age, this was the one TV programme that I most looked forward to being on television, most enjoyed watching, and it's the one that I've got the fondest memories of now.
And I was extremely eligible.
Absolutely.
And it does confuse me though that because I always assumed that you're a lot younger than you are. I would have been like 3 to 9 when this was on and never saw it.
Yeah, I'm 48 now, so
actually older than me.
Yeah, so this is 40 years ago now. And yeah, I've got great memories of it. And it's interesting you mentioned that time gap, because when I went back to watch it for this podcast, I found that everything I remembered about it was correct. And
this is not what I'm discovering when I'm revisiting things for my solo episodes.
Yeah, I mean,
doing better than me.
There's nothing else from that period that I have such a clear recall of. And I think the other reason why I chose it is that the show itself, The Adventure Game, is very much tied to the start of the home computer age.
Right.
So this period, the mid-80s, was the first time that if you were a reasonably affluent family, you could have a computer in your home, something like the Commodore 64 or the ZX Spectrum or the BBC Model B.
Dragon 64.
The Dragon.
It's in keeping with
yellow.
The theme.
Oh, yes.
Dragon made in Wales. The great British computer industry, which sadly fizzled over time.
That's probably why we had it, because we were living in Wales at the time.
Yeah, I never thought of that.
It
all makes sense. So these will be names that are very evocative to people who grew up in that time. And yeah, you could have these home computers and you could experiment and find out what you could do with them and play with them in a way that I think you just can't with computers nowadays, because everything has become so much more complicated and so much of a specialist discipline. So it was a magical time, and I think I'm very lucky to have grown up during that period. And the show The Adventure Game it's really tied to that in its construction, its design, but more than that in the kind of thinking that underpins it. So there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about there. So I'm quite nervous to ask, but what did the two of you make of it?
Well, you've seen it before, haven't you, Dave?
So I'm 52, so I was prime audience for this when it was on the first time around. The main thing that I found really interesting is there were 4 series of the show.
Yeah.
And they were subtly different. And I had quite strong memories of bits from the show, but it turns out they changed the format for each series. And the bits that I remember were scattered across different formats.
Okay.
So every so often I'd go, oh, I remember that bit. Or, oh, I remember that bit. In a way that was like profoundly nostalgic.
Okay.
Even though it was not all of those bits in the same episode, because they were quite different to each other.
Well, you're going to have to elaborate on that at some point, because we watched one episode from season 1, one from season 3, and one from season 4, and they all seemed pretty much the same to me.
Oh.
So, obviously, there were differences that went over my head. I mean, certain, like, cast changes and some things, but...
We'll probably get into this later, but what I find really interesting from what Richard said is that there's definitely some inspirational stuff in there about the way they were using computers that I, you know, took away and made part of, you know, what took me into my career. But also, it was basically a puzzle program. And Richard has become very inspired and very good at doing puzzles in a way that I've not, possibly because I'm just too lazy to get into that kind of thing. But it'd be interesting to talk at some point in time about how inspirational it was for certain young people to go away and get into doing that kind of thing. But But mainly for me, it was excellent periodic nostalgia where I'd be watching the show and going, I remember that bit.
I knew nothing. I had no idea what I was getting into. And my main response would be, what on earth? I mean, what? I was not expecting the people in kind of Blue Peter dragon costumes wandering about.
Well, we can talk about the dragon costumes in a bit.
But I did have a vague kind of cultural osmosis awareness of the Aspidistra, but I had never seen it.
People who've not seen the show are going to go, Aspidistra?
Well, quite. So I mean, perhaps we should have a brief description of the show for anyone who hasn't seen it.
Can I leap into... Before we even do that, for one bit, one of the things that I was really surprised by is it's long,
yes,
for a kids show.
Episodes were nearly 40 minutes.
Because I expected it to be 20,
like 20 minutes.
And because it's 40 minutes, there are when you are like, what? There's a bunch of stuff where somebody is sitting doing a thing for like nearly 10 minutes.
Yeah, and
the
show wasn't long enough. Several times they had to skip past them trying to figure stuff out.
So we will learn
so let's
that, so.
let's just explain what's basically going on because it'll make no sense to your listeners. So this is a game show. It's a game show for children, but the contestants are grown-ups. And every episode there would be a different team of three contestants who worked together. Two of them would be celebrities. So usually they were TV personalities, sometimes sports people. But they're all quite famous people from the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the fun things about going back to this has been to remember all of the stars of the day and what they were famous for.
Mm-hmm.
The third contestant, and I didn't realise this until I read something about it for this podcast, the third contestant is a member of the public.
See, I didn't...
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's probably
either.
Why I couldn't find some of them online.
Right.
See, until I read the Wikipedia page, which is how we get all our information, I didn't know that. But what I also found super interesting, since Richard's mentioned that, is that... By and large, the random, in inverted commas, member of the public they get turns out to be kind of super posh.
They were all very middle class.
So we'll come back to that. I think that there's a lot to say, particularly about visible diversity and area.
It possibly suggests that how little involvement I had with popular culture at the time and in years afterwards, because there was only one of the contestants that I recognised. I recognised one of the cast.
Oh wow!
But out of the six, now I know six rather than nine people that I perhaps should have recognised. I only recognised one of them, and can you guess which one it was?
It would have been Sue Nichols out of Coronation Street.
God no, I've never seen Coronation Street in my life.
Maggie Philbin from Swap Shop.
No.
Was it Duncan Goodhue?
It was Duncan Goodhue.
Oh.
Only one okay. I knew.
I guessed at Sue Nichols because she carried on being in Coronation Street for like decades after she was in the show.
We can.
I did also recognise Moira Stewart, who was one of the dragons.
So that's the biggest surprise of all, isn't it? That Moira Stewart. Now it's just about possible that you have some listeners who don't know who Moira Stewart is. So
she was on the news, wasn't she?
Absolutely, a news presenter from the '80s all the way through to like the 2010s. She was on Frost on Sunday. And it's really surprising and jarring to see her here as a presenter in a children's programme.
She seems quite surprised and jarred by it too.
I mean,
But interestingly, I looked into this, and during that series, that was the first series only, that was 1980, she hadn't been on television, so she'd been a radio presenter.
Oh, really?
So people might know her voice, but they wouldn't have that sort of experience of expecting her to read the news and seeing her there as the host.
Because I recognised her from later years, obviously.
As listeners will know, in terms of disappearing down rabbit holes, we and when I say we, I mean Richard, very sensibly started an explanation of what the show was about, and we didn't really get very far.
So let's carry on with that. So there's a preposterously complicated backstory They're all on an alien planet. We'll go more into that later.
They're also specified as being time travellers, not just space travellers.
Okay, let's just set that aside for the time being, because it is very, very complicated, and there is a lot to talk about. But what's actually happening in the show is that they are playing an escape room.
They are playing an escape room.
Yes.
And
at a time when escape rooms didn't exist.
Right, yeah, this is the really interesting thing about it, that to us, we look at this and they are like obviously playing an escape room. It's exactly like we would do today. So there are keys and there are combination locks, and they unlock a door and they get into another room with more puzzles in, all of those things that we're used to. But yes, this was 25 years before escape rooms were supposedly invented in Japan. So later, let's dig into why it's called the adventure game. That's really interesting. And what it shows about the development of this particular genre, Dave, as you mentioned, the puzzle genre that this represents. But I shouldn't do all the talking, so you've watched a few episodes. So what do you want to dig into?
So we can start with facts, as per usual.
I have a bunch of facts.
I only have one. As usual, I have very few facts.
As often happens, I will go on with facts until Annie throws something at me. So, should I just kick off?
Well, my only fact was that the creator asked Douglas Adams to work on the show, but he was too busy because he was working on the Hitchhiker's Guide TV show.
He only, in fact, asked him to write the first series, which would have been amazing.
And you can see some of those echoes, can't you? I think that some of the... It's quite weird and abstract in some places, and you feel that you can see some of the humour from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, notwithstanding that Douglas Adams wasn't involved, just of the time. You can see that.
He was kind of, he inspired it to a certain extent, the sort of setting and the atmosphere.
It hadn't really occurred to me until just now how remarkably British it is in terms of the humour and the types of characters that are in the show and stuff.
And that's true of TV in general. So at the time that we grew up, there was much more, or I feel there was much more homegrown shows, partly because of the ITV franchising system, the way that each individual ITV region, this was a BBC show, but the way that each individual ITV region had to produce its own content, you felt you had more British stuff on TV.
So what facts do you have?
So let's quickly do some very basic facts. So it was on a combination of BBC One and BBC Two for different seasons between 1980 and 1986, even though there were four seasons, it didn't run continuously for all 6 years. I was surprised it was that early, 1980, gosh. It's often quoted as being the forerunner to Crystal Maze, which maybe?
I mean, you can kind of see some...
Again, an escape room connection. type of programme. So.
I mean, the flaw with that, so I can see why people say that, because they are literally looking for a crystal of the episodes.
Yes.
But the flaw of that argument is that the Crystal Maze is a rip-off of Fort Boyard. People think it's the other way around, because in the UK we had the Crystal Maze first and then Fort Boyard came later.
I'm afraid I don't know what that is.
No, Fort Boyard, it's very like the Crystal Maze. So there is a team who go into individual rooms, play games, and I don't remember exactly what they earn in Fort Boyard, but they get something, and then there's a meta game at the end where they're trying to score points for the leaderboard. In the UK, it was famous because Dirty Den out of EastEnders was played kind of the bad guy. But it was a French show. And when Channel 4 wanted to buy Fort Boyard or make an English language version, they couldn't do it because the actual, the set is literally a sea fort off the coast of France.
Oh, wow.
And that was not available. So instead, they made Crystal Maze. I think the argument that Crystal Maze is based on the adventure game, there's a bit of a weakness there. And whether the people who made Fort Boyard would ever have seen the adventure game?
Probably not.
To know, isn't it?
It is very different, but you can see certain aspects that are vaguely similar.
Yeah.
So it was mostly devised by a gentleman called Patrick Dowling. And he worked on a number of things, including The Railway Children, Secret Garden, Adventures of Tom Sawyer. In season one, the Rango, who is the guy who's in charge, I think, all the characters He's the Rangdo of Arg.
So there is something about the names. I think it might be fun for your listeners to try to work out before we give the game away at the end of the
end
of the show. So yeah, there is a connection between all of the names that we're going to hear here.
So the Rangdo,
yes,
is human. Well, the dragons, when they're interacting with the contestants, intermittently are dragons and also sometimes humans, and their ability to speak English in dragon form changes throughout the seasons. But anyway, in the first season, the Rangdo is a dragon who transforms into a human and is the uncle. And in the third season the episode we watched, it was the Aspidistra plant, and in the fourth season it's a giant teapot.
So you will be shocked by this, but I have discovered that the youth of today do not know what an aspidistra is.
It's not especially surprising.
So we better just fill in that an aspidistra is a type of pot plant which was very fashionable in like the 1930s or something.
Hence, Keep the Aspidistra Flying, which was a book by George Orwell, I believe.
Indeed, yes. This character, which started off as a kind of quite kindly uncle figure, in series one, then turned into basically the king of this planet called Arg by series three, and moreover, rather than transforming into a human shape, was presenting himself as a pot plant.
And trying to evaporate people.
Which is one of the most memorable things from the show, is the talking aspidistra. I mean, not talking in English, but still talking aspidistra is one of the main things that I remember. It was amazing.
He was basically very grumpy. Evaporation. I mean, we are running way ahead of ourselves. Yes.
Do we have any more facts? So Richard, do you have some facts?
I mean, I'm just going to do the very basics. Yeah, there were 22 episodes in all.
Really?
Only 22.
Only 22 across four seasons.
Many.
In 6 years, that's quite small.
So it was 6 years, but there were some very big gaps in there. I think because some of the creatives left the series and it had to be kind of restarted, reinvigorated.
Mm.
And some of those 22 episodes have been wiped. So
yes, I saw that. Yeah. In the BBC archives, kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do we know why?
Well, because they ran out of tape. And tape was expensive, and so they just recorded new things over old things.
Oh,
yeah.
I see.
So
there's a lot of Doctor Who.
So there's nothing sinister
lost.
About it.
No.
I was really surprised to find that still happened in the 1980s, because this is something that you hear about, like 1960s episodes of things. Mm. They were wiped, but no, apparently these were as well. So I think there's one that's forever lost, and some that only exist in bad off-air recordings. But yeah, this was also the age of the video recorder. It was a time when you could have a video recorder in your home, which 10 years earlier you couldn't have done. Some of those episodes survived that way.
So I've got a couple more facts, if that's okay.
Sure.
So I was saying in season one, the Rangdo, the person who goes on to a dragon that goes on to be King of Arg, where it's based in later seasons, was played by a gentleman called Ian Mester, who, having not just wandering around in a dragon costume, also invented both Just a Minute, which I believe is one of the longest running radio shows in the world on Radio 4, and also Family Fortunes.
Oh, really? Wow.
So that
I mean,
was
there's no,
quite
there's
random.
No guarantee. I wouldn't imagine that the people in the dragon costumes were necessarily the human characters who were then represented.
Oh,
necessarily. Well, I can't imagine Maura Stewart in a dragon costume.
I mean, I'd like to, I'd like to think it was.
She already looked a bit uncomfortable in a blue jumpsuit.
One more last thing on facts, because there's always one more thing. If you get through the episodes and you get right to the end and you look at the credits, in the credits it says, each time, the name of the human character as played by, and then the name of the dragon character.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah. So I think we've really got to explain the backstory now, because otherwise we're going to be making increasingly little sense as we talk about these things.
I mean, that's not anywhere much of a departure from normal.
So to me as an adult, this seems ridiculously over-engineered and complicated and just preposterous. But the reason why I can explain it to you now is because I remember from when I was a kid. So on some level, it really worked.
Okay.
So it evolved a little bit over the course of the series. But the way that I remember it from sort of my generation of shows was that what we were watching was not really a BBC production. It was a interstellar broadcast mm-hmm. from the planet Arg, which was made by these...
Argovision,
yes. Which was made by these aliens who lived on Arg called Argons. There's another of those made-up words. And was made for their entertainment as a show that they watched in the evenings. And the humans would travel through space and also somehow through time, this was never explained, to take part in the game, kind of voluntarily, like we would do an escape room.
See, that wasn't how it was seen to me.
So in the first series, it was different.
Okay.
And this was a discovery for me. I hadn't understood that this, but in the first series, it was really darker. And the Argons had basically captured the humans who were visiting their planet because they were fed up with all this tourism and had taken away the crystal that powered the human spacecraft,
yes.
and they had to play the adventure game to get the crystal back. But yeah, over time, the whole show got a bit less scary, and maybe that was me growing up. You know, maybe that was just I was less easily scared by really quite trivial things. But maybe also they did just soften it up and made
well,
it more into.
I mean,
kids
even
show.
Even in the voiceover in the episode 3 of season 1 that we watched, where it said that they were trying to find their crystal to power the time machine to get home, it did say that the Argons liked playing tricks on people and had a playful sense of humour.
Regrettable sense of humour.
A regrettable
is,
sense
is the
of
phrase
humor.
That's used several times
yes.
in the show.
So there wasn't ever really any, you know, major threat. And even though people did get evaporated if they failed the last puzzle, it was said that it just meant that they had to walk further to get home.
There were
yes.
lots of, yeah.
Every
yes.
every time they,
so they
mention
didn't actually die.
Every time they mention, I'm just going to repeat what you said. Every time they mention that someone's going to be evaporated, they did make a point
they
of
did
saying.
Say,
that they
it
weren't
just means
being
that they've got further to walk.
So there were two types.
So it was never actually really menacing.
That's true. But as a you know, as a 7 or 8 year old, so if you were evaporated, there were two types of evaporation in the show. If you were eaten by the vortex, and we'll have to talk about the vortex, but at the end of the game, there was a final game, and if you lost that final game, then you were in quote marks evaporated. And we didn't see it in the show that we watched, but they would always explain that the other members of the team could pick up the person who'd been evaporated on their way past, so
yes.
they weren't stranded in space forever.
Yeah.
Unless they
and
were all evaporated.
If all three of them were evaporated, then you would usually see them waiting at a bus stop. against the stellar background.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah. The other way you could be evaporated was if you broke the rules of the game.
Yes.
So, for instance, setting off an alarm after you've been
mm-hmm.
clearly warned that you couldn't do a thing because it was set off the alarm.
Or putting your feet in the acid.
Or putting your feet in the bottomless acid bath and all of that kind of thing. You would be evaporated and sent to what was kind of a sin bin.
Yes.
Called the Black Hole. And the Black Hole was a mini game.
Yes, I was impressed because one of the episodes we saw, one of the contestants was put into the black hole for breaking the rules. And in another of the episodes that we watched, someone had to actually go into the mines, which was very similar. Mm. And they would be in pitch blackness and the other two contestants would be able to see them on a monitor and kind of direct them how to get out. And if I had been the person who was in pitch blackness, I would not have been able to do anything at all. I would have been completely paralysed with terror. And even if people had been talking to me on the phone going, it's fine, you can just walk forwards, I would have just gone, nope, not going to happen. So I'm assuming that beforehand, because even though one of the, presumably who was the member of the public who did the mines.
Yes, that's right.
I assume that they would have been told the sorts of things that they would have to do and agreed to do it. But she seemed a little bit,
maybe.
You know, iffy about it.
There were some scary aspects of the adventure
yes.
game. And the black hole, I actually found quite scary because
yes.
I could imagine myself being in the black
yes.
hole. And I think that if I'd just watched it for the first time now as an adult, I wouldn't have seen that. I wouldn't have understood that there was a real element of peril to
no,
some
I,
of what
as
you,
I say,
what you saw
I there. Was, you know, imagining myself being on the show. And for most of it, thinking of my experience of doing escape rooms where I am completely useless and I can never pretty much figure out anything before anybody else does. And also then, if I had been the person who was in the black hole, I would not have been able to function in any way because I'm not keen
yeah.
on the dark.
Yeah. The other thing about the black hole is that they emerged, once they had been guided out of the black hole, it was revealed that they had been behind a door which was labelled baggy bottoms only. And I didn't understand that as a kid, and I don't understand it now.
I don't want to know either.
No. There was a host in each series, which started off as Moira Stewart, and then it went on to being someone called Charmaine Gradwell, who did then have a career as a Shakespearean actor.
Oh.
I'm saying that like I know that because I looked her up on IMDb, but went on.
Okay.
And then in the, I'm just going to skip over that interjection from Dave. And then in the final series, it was Sarah Lamb. So there was always one host, and then there were people who played the Argons. And
I thought they were meant to be Argons as well.
Oh yes, sorry, they were. You're right. The hosts are Argons as well, and there were people who played the other.
They were less characters and more kind of explainers.
Yes, and I think the most impressive of all of those was a guy called Bill Homewood, who played Rongad, and Rongad is the one who speaks backwards.
He was amazing, because he just went on and on and on, and if you'd worked it all out, I mean, I understood, I was appreciative of the fact that whilst the contestants understood that was what he was doing, they couldn't figure out what he was saying, because he just went so fast.
Yeah.
And he just carried on in a perfectly conversational way, saying things that were completely relevant to the situation, apparently without having to think about it.
And he responded to things they said, so it's not like he just kind of learnt off heart.
A script, no.
Yeah, yeah.
That was amazing.
And another thing to mention there is this was, as I've already said, this was the age of the video recorder. So you could, if you had a video recorder, go back and listen to him multiple times work out what he was saying.
Yes.
And there were a few shows around that time which I think responded to the fact that you could now watch things multiple times. And yeah, I imagine that this is one of those. Shall we talk about James Burke? So James Burke was the male contestant from Series 1.
We're leaping into episode one.
I found it interesting that in all three, the contestants were two women and one man.
That's kind of a coincidence. It's a coincidence of the way that I chose them. So the celebrities were always a man and a woman, and then the member of the public was sometimes a woman and sometimes a man.
Okay,
so it just happens to be the way that I chose them.
So what did you want to say about James Burke?
So James Burke... He's a big character. He is still alive. He was presenting TV shows in the 1960s. He presented Tomorrow's World in the early 70s. It's really interesting, in that episode you have James Burke and you have Maggie Philbin, who are both famous for presenting Tomorrow's World, but this was after James Burke had finished and before Maggie Philbin had started.
Oh, how interesting.
See, what's interesting about Maggie Philbin is that at this point in time, Noel Edmonds is running a thing called Multicolored Swap Shop, which is like your morning kids' TV show. I want to think it was the first thing in the UK done in that format, but I'm only saying that because it's the one that I remember at that age. And it was cartoons and silly stuff on kids' morning TV. And Maggie Philbin and Keith Chegwin, who I believe is her brother, I think, were like two silly knockabout people on the show. And that's what she was known for at the time this was on. She then went on to do Tomorrow's World, as you say, and is now best known for being a science communicator.
Ah,
and, you know,
fair enough.
Went into a very different career. And I found that interesting because obviously James Burke, who is a great personal hero of mine.
He's not a great personal hero of mine based on this episode of this show.
Is best known for a show called Connections, which he did a version of in the 90s, I think, possibly the 80s, but also did another version of last year, an entirely new version, like, you know, 30-odd years after doing the first one, which is incredibly good. Sorry, Richard, you were saying.
Well, I mean, James Burke, I wouldn't say he was a hero, but he's certainly someone that I respect a lot as a science communicator, technology communicator.
Mm.
But I have to say, in this episode, he disgraces himself. He really does.
It wasn't great.
He was not in any way good in this episode. Well, he was very smart, but he wasn't very good at allowing other people to speak ever.
I mean, he comes across. I mean, it It's important to say, as I say, he's still alive, and none of us would want to be judged on 30 minutes of TV footage from 40.
From the mid-80s as well, fair enough. Looking at it from a modern lens,
I mean,
he did sort of say, oh, good girl, several times to the other contestants.
There was also
the grabbing of the young lady's hips without asking her consent. Admittedly, yes, he was attempting to make her feel secure in trying to do something where she was unbalanced, so maybe fair enough. But when the guy who talked backwards came on, his words were, "Are you backward?"
Yes.
Oh wow! I didn't notice that. Oh gosh.
And I mean, yes, it was the early 80s, but
It was a joke that fell utterly flat, and everybody in the room obviously knew it had fallen utterly flat, and it's amazing that they didn't edit it out. Just on the good girl thing, because I absolutely picked up on that myself.
Yeah.
But did you notice that Ruth Maddock
also said
that,
it?
Yes.
I have that written down.
Yes.
I
it didn't bother me when she did it. Hypocrisy for me.
Well, I suspect that the phrase just had a different connotation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm saying, I mean, I will keep repeating, it was the early 80s. And yes, I'm looking at it from a very modern viewpoint.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not saying it was the early 80s, so we just have to expect that kind of thing.
No.
I'm saying perhaps it just didn't mean the same thing then.
It would not have been left in the show nowadays, is what I'm saying.
However, even leaving that aside, you know, James Burke comes across as very condescending, intellectually arrogant, everything that is dislikable about that kind of figure, you know, that kind of very smart communicator, which I found really unfortunate.
So I am nodding away and agreeing with everything that Richard says, despite the fact that he's still a personal hero of mine, which makes me feel very conflicted about things. But
he also messes up really basic maths.
Did he?
Yes.
So, I missed that.
Yes, he did.
So, look, as I've said...
Well, the half dozen.
The half dozen thing.
Yes.
I got that, and I
can't do maths.
And he's very confident that he remembers the routes. At the end, there's a game where they have to remember a route across a maze that they took earlier on.
Yeah.
And he's very confident that he remembers and the others don't, and he gets it wrong. And it's all just quite embarrassing.
Yeah.
As I've said, you can't judge a person by edited footage from 40 years ago, but it was a bit sad. But I do think that the others, like Duncan Goodhue in Series 3, I think he kind of redeemed my perception of
he was very good. He had one moment, was it him?
Oh, he told a women's driving joke.
Yes, he did tell a women's driving joke.
Yes,
you
know,
I also
but
read
it. He tells it in a very ironic way. You know, he knows that this is... Yeah.
Can I just go back to the first episode? I may be wrong here, so correct me if I've misheard what's happening, but you were talking about Maggie Fibble and James Burke, and they do some introductions for the people at the start of the show. I don't think they even named the non-famous person who was there.
No, they did.
I think they just said, with Maggie Fibble and James Burke.
No,
and
because
went
I looked, I was trying to look her up because I didn't,
oh,
her name was
okay.
Pat Cater. I was trying to look her up because I didn't know that they were members of the public. But yes, I think as the only male contestant on his episode, Duncan Goodhue was very supportive and encouraging.
Yeah. Yeah, and Heinz Wolf. Heinz Wolf. It was in the episode we watched out of Series 4. Another iconic figure. And he is playing a character. You know, I can't believe that Heinz Wolf is really like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he played the character
now
very well.
And he seemed to be more kind of into it than most of the other people.
Yes,
he was
obviously having a good time.
He was really enthusiastic, and I very strongly suspect that one of the sort of mini games that they played in that was specifically designed for Heinz Wolf, because all of the stuff that they had to do with, they had to like set up a dynamo and create an electric.
Oh, with him figuring out the wires on the bike.
And his main show was called The Great Egg Race, which was exactly, it was doing that. It was like making contraptions out of bits and pieces.
I don't think it was just the James Burke aspect, but the first season episode I found quite painful. It was all very painfully awkward.
Hmm. down
across the board, and it did improve. I mean, the other two I thought were much better.
Yeah, I think people kind of
like relaxed into it a lot more. Even the because the butler guy was the same across the whole lot, yes. And he was less awkward later on.
Yeah, so we haven't mentioned the butler at all. So there is a character called Gandor. There's another of those names, who plays a kind of old retainer throughout all four series. And he's quite a comic character,
yeah,
but
he's a bit slapstick.
He's a bit slapstick, yeah.
Quite a bit of gurning.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But it's, you know, it's a sympathetic character. They're not kind of making fun of
it. Oh, yeah. No, and he did very well with the hints, I think.
Yes.
When people were getting stuck, he would like turn up and give cryptic clues, which I thought were very clever.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming he wasn't coming up with that on the spot, but
no.
I thought the way that it was organised, I mean, they would have to... whoever it was who was coming up with the clues would have to come up with them reasonably quickly, yes, based on what the people were doing.
Yeah. You know, I agree with you about the series one episode just seeming a bit forced. And
yeah.
I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? That they're still kind of settling.
Oh, yeah,
into
it was only episode three.
But I thought there was... yeah, one of the puzzles in the series, what episode? The one about lying and telling the truth, and they have like 20 seconds to solve this.
Yeah, that's super
complicated.
Hard.
It was a really hard logic puzzle, and they had sort of 20 seconds to try to solve it.
I mean,
it.
I was well on the way to working out how to do it, but I would have taken like at least 5 minutes to work that out.
And remembering that this was a kids' show, it's just...
Yeah, yeah.
There's something they did really well, and I don't remember whether they did it in Series 1, but they certainly did it in the later series, which is they would have a kind of vignette where the Argons were explaining to each other how the puzzles work.
Yeah. That was one of the things.
And they would do that before the puzzle, which in some ways was a little odd, because they'd say... effectively, this is a puzzle room, and this is how the people who are going to come into it will need to do things to solve it. And then you watch them do it, which is kind of spoilery.
No,
and kind
I
of
liked
takes
it.
Away the...
I liked it because for me, because I would have been completely clueless about all of it. So the more complicated aspects of it being explained beforehand, so that I could watch and know what they were supposed to do and see how they did things differently or how they've worked stuff out, was much better for me. But I thought the way they presented the puzzles overall was very hit and miss, because those ones where they kind of went through all the different stages and then you could see the contestants sort of trying to work it out and then what the hints meant and kind of stuff, I really appreciated. I did think it was really amusing that they had this pit of supposedly bottomless acid, and they had there were stilts, and one of them was on the far side and one of them was on the near side, and you could actually just put the stilt across the gap
very...
and then just walk on it.
Yeah.
But and they didn't do that. They made it much harder for themselves, purely because Duncan Goodhue has such long legs. They actually managed to get across just on his own and then passed the stilts back, and the other two contestants actually went over on the stilts. I thought, oh my God.
But
the people watching must have been going, this is bad, because they're not actually meant to be using the stilts.
But Duncan Goodhue, if I remember correctly, it said, if you put your feet in the bottomless pit of acid, terrible things will happen
to
you. And so what he effectively did was do a cartwheel. He stuck his hands in it and then flipped himself over the top.
Because it said you were allowed
to
walk on your hands. So he put his hands in the pit and then stepped across. It was very impressive.
So I think...
I just wanted to finish my point. That some of the others... I struggled with, particularly the ones where they had the floor covered in different coloured shapes, because they had to work out different things to do.
We'll do that now.
And then in the season 4 episode, they started trying to figure it out, and then they cut out the section where they figured it out, and then they were just doing it.
Yes.
I was like, I don't understand how they're doing what they're doing, because we have not seen them work out how it works.
That was weird how they cut that bit out, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So the editing is ropey in quite a few places.
I understand they had to make it fit the time.
They had to make it fit the time, but a thing to bear in mind here is that a lot of the games were the same in multiple episodes.
So
you watched the series, it was explained before. And also the explanations, they never quite explain everything, because they're leaving something for the kids watching at home to work out for themselves. So I think it's quite well pitched for the age of audience that it's intended for. Having said
What do you think the age is that it's intended for? That's a really interesting question.
Oh, well, I'm assuming that it was for my age, because it seemed like really suitable when I watched it. So that would be, as I say, 8, 9, 10, that kind
of... The season 3 episode, there were incredibly painfully awkward viewers trying to answer a puzzle.
Oh gosh, that was really weird, wasn't
phoning
it?
Phoning in. and they looked about 9 to me.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that was a very strange segment, and I think actually it's, I don't know whether it seems stranger or less strange now to us, because they're being filmed talking on a phone.
Yeah.
So like a camera crew has gone to their school or home or whatever, and then they filmed them on the phone so that it can make it look like they're having this phone call with an alien on a planet far, far, far away.
It was very weird.
The whole thing that was going on there didn't really come across from the particular episodes that we watched, for whatever reason it wasn't featured. But what was happening there is this character, the Randgo that we talked about, who is the Aspidistra, who's really bad-tempered, he's the King of Ark. The contestants are supposed to give him presents, and he either likes or doesn't like the present. If he doesn't like it, then they get evaporated. and if he does like it, then they win a hamburger. And the thing about the hamburger is that they can use that to get a kind of a free move in the vortex.
Oh, which didn't happen in the episode. They mentioned that they were supposed to give him a present, but they didn't have anything.
Which I think must be for time. You know, that bit was just kind of cut out of that episode. Shall we talk about the vortex? Because that's such a big part of the show.
We'll come back. So I'd rather talk about the games in order that they happen briefly, if that's okay. So you mentioned a game where there was a floor that was covered in squares that had symbols on, that had colours and shapes. So you might have a red circle or a green square, this type of thing. I thought it was interesting that, as Richard said, it might be explained in different episodes if you watch the whole season. Because that was a thing that was consistent all the way through the show, I wondered whether as a contestant you might turn up in season 4.
And already know how it works. Yeah.
But it certainly didn't seem that way from the way they were getting it wrong.
It was slightly different.
But I
never figured out how you were supposed
to figure
out the pattern for that.
But my recollection for that was that the value of the... might be the money, not necessarily the squares on the ground, it was the colours of the rainbow number multiplied by the number of sides. And I remember that from when I was like 10, the value of a thing. And then you could work out what the numbers were and you had to do them in order. So
it was much, much simpler than that. You have conjured up a magnificently complicated...
Nobody would ever be able to figure that out.
I do remember something like that. So maybe there was like one episode where that was a puzzle or something.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're talking about there is called the Drogna game, and I never understood the Drogna game as a kid. But as an adult, the answer's on the wall. There's a plaque behind them,
that's the order, is it? Okay, yeah. I wondered about that.
And it, rather weirdly, you know, this was never explained in any of the episodes that I went back and watched.
Mm.
And again, it's a right level puzzle for a kid. I think they can feel very clever at having spotted it, and maybe it's not explained on purpose. So
because in both of those, they cut out the bit where the contestants figured out how to do it.
So the first episode they get across it by trial and error, and James Burke specifically says, I have no idea how we managed to do that.
Yeah,
which is why Richard said when they came back to it they got it completely wrong, which is really amusing. I really like the fact that when they stepped on the wrong square, there's somebody off camera with some kind of squeaky toy who was just going squeak, and then when there were like lots of them doing it simultaneously, he was getting very enthusiastic squeak, 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 thing.
It was a kind of comic element. Well, it was like sort of clown's nose kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was that one. They all had some kind of computer game. I thought that was interesting because there are, for people again, as Richard said, of you know, a certain type of household might have a home computer. Those might have these text-based adventure games, of which there are a bunch around at the time, particularly ones done by a company called Level 9 that I was a massive fan of. But what was really interesting about the way they were interacting with the computer games is obviously they weren't playing against a game. They were playing against somebody off-screen who was typing the responses and triggering whether certain things happened or not, because they were sometimes typing really complicated English sentences that there's no way the computer would be able to understand.
Not always spelling it correctly.
Yeah, yet these things were still working. So I thought that setup was obviously really clever.
And again, watching it at the time versus watching it now, at the time it would have been really exciting because it would have been incredibly new. But for me now, watching someone type incredibly slowly on a 1980s computer keyboard was not particularly
engaging. Some of those sections were over 10 minutes long.
So I really want to talk about this, so there's going to be a massive rabbit hole here.
Go for it.
Buckle in, buckle in. But the TV show is called The Adventure Game,
yes.
And we haven't really talked about why it's called that.
Mm.
So there was a genre of computer game in the 1980s which was called an adventure game. And for anybody who knew anything about the genre in the 80s, that is what the phrase adventure game meant.
Oh.
And Dave's already referred to it. It was text-based. Sometimes they had illustrations, but they were only illustrations.
You mean just that was a term for the general genre of type, you know, north, south, yeah. east, west, take, fish.
Exactly.
Okay, because
so.
I played
exactly
a lot of those,
so.
And I'm not aware of that as a term.
So there was a fancier version of them, which aspired to be more literary.
Okay.
And they would describe themselves as interactive fiction.
Mm.
So for any of our listeners who are familiar with Infocom, a very great company in this area, they would call their work interactive fiction.
Mm.
But there was another type which was referred to as an adventure game, which was for entertainment. It was for puzzles. You'd have to do ludicrous things like throw the chewing gum at the fire-eating dragon because the dragon would try to swallow it and then it would gum up its nostrils. They would be puzzles that would be that obscure.
My all-time favourite one was in one of the level 9 games, which was a spy game, and you knew the bad guys were going to be landing in an aeroplane and you were at the airfield and you had to find the dynamite. You had to unscrew the bulb on the runway, screw the dynamite into where the bulb was, and then switch it on to blow the plane up when it landed.
Okay.
Yeah. And...
and you didn't have the internet to look up how to do stuff, which is what I do on all the games I play.
I mean, I could spend hours talking about interactive fiction and adventure games. Maybe there's a whole other podcast in that. But I mean, all I will say is I went back and played one called Snowball, which was one of the level 9 games.
Oh, I love that game.
I did this about a year ago, and I remember Snowball taking me like months to finish.
Hmm.
And coming back to it, as a grown-up now, of course, I did it in about like 2 or 3 hours without looking anything up on the internet. And that's just the sort of level of sophistication that we've achieved, I think, through playing many of these that we kind of understand what to do. Anyway, the TV show, The Adventure Game, is an adventure game made real.
Right.
So the things that they're having to do, like taking the coin and putting the coin in the slot, and you're doing all of those things, you could imagine playing through a computer game where you were typing.
I could.
Yeah.
That's really interesting because the original adventure game was a thing called Colossal Cave, which was came out in the late 60s, I think, in one of the early kind of mainframe university computers. Somebody created one of these things. And like Richard, I can talk about these kind of things for hours. And it's just really interesting to think that it might be the case that something like Dungeons and Dragons might have inspired somebody writing Colossal Cave, and then Colossal Cave might have inspired escape rooms because it's building those kind of puzzles in real life. That's really interesting.
Exactly that. So you have just had in real time the realization that I had a week ago when I started to think about this, that there is a straight line from Colossal Cave, which is way, way back in the past, the days of mainframes, through text-based adventure games like I played on the Commodore 64, through the adventure game, the TV series, leading to escape rooms. And I'd never really seen that progression progression before.
That's really cool.
And then, to make it as meta as it could possibly be, inside the TV show, The Adventure Game, they play an adventure game on the computer.
Yes.
And I agree, it's quite a slow thing to watch now, but that was definitely my favourite part of the
I would imagine
the
at the time, when it was all new.
Because it was seeing our own experience reflected on the screen. You know,
yeah,
we played those games, hear people playing them. I guess like people watch Twitch for video games.
Yes.
But it's an interesting combination because one of the members of the public in one of the episodes, when they go into one of the rooms, said, oh, it's one of those lateral thinking puzzles. So there's elements of the adventure game, but there's also, I don't know, a man goes into a lift and he needs to get to the 20th floor, but he can't. Why not? You know,
lateral thinking was
a
very...
Because he's short. You know, that's a terrible example, but, you know, lateral thinking puzzles go back thousands of years, presumably.
But it was a very hot thing in the 80s. Do you remember that? Edward de Bono and all of those? Yeah, it was having its moment. So again, there are all these little references to things I remember from the time which come out there. And Yeah, the best thing for me about the whole adventure game sequence when they're playing the computer is the Dognar. Did you remember the Dognar from...
The little robot.
The little robot.
I didn't remember that.
So there's a little robot dog called a Dognar, another of those words. Have you spotted the connection yet? and they solve a puzzle to kind of activate it, and then it goes into a hole in the wall, and then it is playing the
adventure game. You can see where it is on the screen.
It's kind of the protagonist. So there was a lovely link there between the physical world and the virtual world, which blew my mind when I was a little kid. And the Dognar itself, again, is quite of its time, because this was the day of the turtle. You used to get this really strange thing which you could attach to a computer. It's called a turtle, and it had a pen in it, and you gave it instructions like left, right, up, down, and it would draw on a piece of paper under the instructions of the the computer.
In a similar way, I was quite small, had a toy called Big Track.
Big Track is a similar thing. So Big Track you could program in advance, and the Dognar is kind of like a futuristic fantasy version of the turtle or of Big Track.
I found its voice and personality out of keeping.
It is, but I actually had this down as a note for when we come to talk about diversity, as I'm sure we will. So the Dognar talks with a Cockney voice in Series 3 and a kind of a Scouse accent in Series 4. And you didn't tend to hear those accents on television at that time.
Ooh,
so I think it is quite an interesting choice that they gave it regional accents. Mm. It has got this kind of very laconic personality. It can't really quite be bothered to be there, but
it didn't feel very kind of children's TV-ish. It felt a bit out of keeping, as I said.
I don't know.
Yeah,
that's okay to me.
I mean, there were moments, because there was at one point where it must have been the Season 4 one, when they were interacting with the giant teapot, and there was a tassel, and someone touched it, and the butler went, "Oh, don't do that. He gets excited if you touch his tassels." And I was like, what?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
slightly concerning.
The thing about the accents with the... sorry, not the accents, but the kind of attitude of the Dognar, I definitely don't remember from the time. And I did really enjoy it now. So maybe it was one of those things that's put in for grown-ups.
Because there are probably people watching it with their kids, it's true. Same with the tassel joke, because kids aren't going to get that.
Yeah, yeah.
Vortex.
We've got to talk about the Vortex. We've mentioned the Vortex a dozen times, and if we don't actually tell people what the Vortex is... then they're going to unsubscribe and leave nasty comments. Okay, so the Vortex was the final thing they had to do after they completed the escape rooms. Before they could board their spaceship and go back to Earth, they had to get across this kind of latticework of triangles, which was supposed to be suspended in the middle of space. Although occasionally they accidentally stepped off it and nothing bad really happened.
It was another green screen effect where you've got this big space background and this lattice work looks like a bridge across.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, as a kid, I found that quite scary. The idea of plummeting into the depths of space was quite real to me. And they were crossing this lattice work, and from the other direction, from the far end, there was the Vortex was approaching them. And they took a move, and the Vortex took a move, and so on, alternating.
Of course, they can't see the Vortex.
They can't see where the Vortex is.
Well, I had a question, because I couldn't... It was more clear in the Season 4 episode than the Season 3 episode. But I didn't think that there was any way for them to figure it out. Not completely.
No, they couldn't. So that was why they wanted to have won those hamburgers that I talked about, because they could place a hamburger in front of them on a space, and if the Vortex was there, then the Vortex would eat the hamburger.
Was there a rule that if they were standing on a space and the Vortex was on a space next to them, the Vortex had to move away? It couldn't move onto them.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Yes.
So I mean, we haven't really explained that if they step onto the Vortex, then they lose and they get evaporated, and one of the three of the team has to successfully get across. to...
That was one of the things that I found really interesting about it, was that in the first two episodes, I don't know whether this was indicative, but in the first two episodes we watched, all three contestants were evaporated, and in the last episode we watched, only one of them made it out.
That often happened. Yeah, they often lost.
It was pretty hard.
Yeah. I think we have finally come to the end of the episodes that we watched.
Yes, I think so. Shall we move on to diversity? Yeah, so we've talked about James Burke and unfortunateness. I mean, it was more women than men, especially in the episodes that we saw.
And in terms of the construction of the game, I mean, the group dynamics were sometimes a bit awkward.
Yeah.
But in terms of the construction of the game, there was equality there. Everybody,
yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. Yes. And in terms of racial diversity, I mean, it was pretty much 100% white. I mean, there was Moira Stewart in season one and Sarah Lamb in season four.
Moira Stewart wasn't really in it very much. She had a couple of sentences at the start and the end of the show, and yes, that was basically...
And it was painfully middle class.
So I don't.
And then you made the
agree.
Point about the dog.
Yeah, I don't completely agree with your conclusions about ethnicity. Because, yes, so the contestants were all white. And I wondered whether that was my bias coming through in the episodes that I'd selected. But I went back and looked at some more, and I couldn't find a single person who wasn't white in all of the episodes that we had access to.
Right.
For the celebrities, you can say that's maybe a function of the age, but it feels a bit gratuitous that the members of the public were so non-diverse. But I actually think it's quite important that Moira Stewart and Sarah Lamb are in it.
Absolutely. No, I thought that was great.
Yeah, I think they're... Yeah,
I wasn't criticising.
I think there has to be an element of choice there.
Yes.
And it made me think that actually kids' TV, and particularly the BBC in the 1980s, the presenters were much more diverse than you might have expected them to be.
I mean, I do remember that being a thing, but was it as early as the 1980s?
Oh, definitely, because I remember presenters.
And there's a children's, a school's TV series that I remember watching called Look and Read, which I went back and looked at a few episodes from, and the presenter there was black, which I had not remembered at all. And why should I? The whole point of this is to make it...
That's really interesting.
Yeah, to show us how normal it is. So no, I think that was an intentional choice, and I think they deserve credit for it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I agree that everybody, including Moira Stewart, is very middle class. and yeah, we can't challenge that, except perhaps for the Dobner.
Yes, indeed. Did you want to talk about the names? Because they were all anagrams of the same collection of letters, but was there some specific significance to the letters used?
Well, Dave has been bursting to tell us all the way through, so I'll hand over to Dave. They're all anagrams of...
Dragon.
Dragon.
Yeah, I word for a living, don't you know, but anagrams are not my thing.
Yes. So, talking of which, I mean, I don't know if you have any insight into this, Richard, but there is a healthy community of puzzling people in the world. It's not perhaps especially large, but there's lots of puzzle books you can buy in the shops, and there are international puzzle competitions and stuff. Was that a thing all the way back in the 80s or previously, or is it a thing that's just grown up more recently?
Well, my brother and I always used to do the logic puzzle books. We used to have those with the grids and the questions.
Oh, again,
and
in the 1980s?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I remember that very strongly from when I was little. Word searches was a big thing when I was little.
And there was my parents used to take a magazine called Tough Puzzles, which were more like the kind of puzzles that you would do on a puzzle hunt nowadays. That kind of thing. So yeah, I think this does go back a long way. Martin Gardner had those books of mathematical puzzles, which go way. He's been around for decades.
That used to be. I feel it was something that parents used to get to amuse their kids in the summer holidays, was the A4 books of puzzles with the slightly grey newspapery type paper with all the different types of puzzles in them. Yeah, we always had those.
So it's interesting that
I was rubbish at them, but so I liked the logic ones.
So it's interesting that in some ways the kind of market for this was already kids doing the logic puzzles plus kids with computers doing adventure games, and so it feels like there are a lot of different things building up to the idea of this kind of show.
Yeah, it's kind of responding and building on and being another step in the journey. So I think that wraps it up for this month's discussion. So it's on to the ratings. And I know as a loyal listener that you have a, that you do ratings out of five with half stars allowed. So Dave, what was your rating for the adventure game?
So I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. I was very surprised how long the episodes were. I do not think we'd have young young people, as I wrote in italics in my notes.
I can't imagine
kids
today watching this.
I literally wrote kids today, as I say, in italics to make a point of my not knowing anything about kids today. Sitting down for 40 minutes to watch a thing. But I was engrossed. I really enjoyed it. I was particularly overcome with nostalgic emotion when they wandered into the room with the little boats, because I was like, oh my god, it's real. I had a literal jaw-dropping moment, which so I'm going to give it four. I'm going to give it a solid four. I really enjoyed it.
And Annie?
Well, I have to admit I struggled with the first episode, the season one episode. I enjoyed quite a bit of the season three episode, and I enjoyed a lot more of the season four episode. So I'm going to give it three, because I would have given the first one two, and the last one four, and the middle one three. So I'm gonna consolidate on three. How about you?
Well, you've been very very fair and even-handed there, but I'm the guest, so I'm not going to be fair and even-handed. I'm going to disregard season one, because the one that I remember was seasons three and four, and it's everything I remember it being. Watching it again took me right back to what was a very magical time, I think, to be growing up. The editing wasn't great. There were a few moments when they didn't explain things, so I'm going to go for four and a half.
Entirely fair. And I think we know the answer to this question, the biggest question of all. Did you still love it?
I think you've worked that out, haven't you? I absolutely adored it. It was like being young again. And there are so few things in life that can give you that feeling.
Oh, well, I'm very pleased that we provided that experience for you, because we've been wanting to have you on the show for a while and we've been struggling to think of something. So I'm glad that you enjoyed the thing you picked.
Oh, well, that's very kind. And I now have the special pleasure of being the very first person to know what Dave has picked for Annie in the next show.
Okay, so I'm going to pick a TV show.
Okay.
Which I probably should have looked up the date, but probably the early 60s.
Oh, gosh.
It's an episodic TV show rather than a straight line one. I'm going to pick two or three of my favourite episodes from the original version of The Twilight Zone.
Oh, no, really?
It's so good.
This is going to be scary. Okay, well, might have to eject you from the flat forevermore if I'm traumatised, but go on.
So that's it for this month's episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? Many thanks, as ever, to Cambo for our theme music. And thank you ever so much to Richard for joining us for our discussion of this excellent TV show for this episode. And thank you, everybody, so much for listening. If you like the show, please remember to rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you have any comments, or if you want to tell us about a time you shared some media you love and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can email us at willyoustilloveit@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
And please come and join us next time to find out what Annie thinks of my favourite episodes from The Twilight Zone.
Oh dear. And whether or not Dave still loves it after our discussion.
Bye-bye.
Bye everyone.